that is a lot of excitement for 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. But I was just thinking, like, 3 o'clock is not your usual sort of church time, but what a blessing it is that we're here and we don't have to be at home watching the Eagles play. Anyway, so a couple of weeks ago, you're welcome. A couple of weeks ago, we began this this series called A Journey Towards the Cross. And what we're doing in this series is that we are slowing down the events of Holy Week. And last week, Pastor Rena gave us a look at what happened on the day that Jesus entered the temple and he flipped some tables. And the week before, we started with Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. The stories of Holy Week are stories that, like, many of us who've grown up in church or would have called ourselves Christians for a while, we could probably retell if you were asked, if you were put on the spot. You know, some of us have heard them since we were kids in kids' church. But sometimes the danger with familiar stories is that we remember the outline, but we miss the weight of them. And so what we are doing is that we are walking our way through these stories and we're saying to God in this that we just don't want to just know the story. We want to enter into it. That we're not just here to admire Jesus, but we want to follow him. And that as God moves amongst us and speaks to us, that we would then be open and ready to respond to him. Now, if you are new to joining us in this series, this journey towards the cross takes place in the final week of Jesus' life. It's the final 7 days, and it's happening during the Jewish festival of Passover. Jerusalem is full to overflowing. It's got hundreds of thousands of visitors, and they've all descended into town to retell the story of when God had set his people free and it released them out of slavery through Moses. Every year, Jewish families, they would gather around the Passover table and they would retell the story of Moses and the plagues and the night of deliverance. And they would eat this meal and they would tell the story. And they would all remember that God sets his people free. But we remember here that there's a tension that's going on here. That they're telling a freedom story while still living under Roman occupation. And so as they celebrate Passover and the things that have happened, there was still this hope that he would do it again. Because everywhere you looked in all this, you were reminded that the Jewish people were being controlled by the brutal force of Rome. Coins had Caesar's image on them. They said, Son of God. Military's banners flew. Roman soldiers patrolled the streets. And just outside the city walls stood Roman crosses. This public reminder of what happens when you challenge the empire. And so now, a little further away from Jerusalem, about 3 kilometers away, in a small village of Bethany, there's a dinner party. And it's happening at the home of Simon the leper. Except he's not a leper anymore. He's been healed. But as we know, like, sometimes, like, nicknames stick, don't they? Like, you know, you guys know what I mean. Like, you did this one thing in year 9, Jeremy. And then 25 years later, like, you are still known for that, right? Like, you're that guy. Like, Simon had been healed by Jesus, and his whole life had been completely changed. Because leprosy in the ancient world didn't just attack your body, it took your whole life. Like, it meant isolation, it meant exclusion, it meant being cut off from your family and your friends and your community. And you lived outside of the town, you were untouchable, you were unwelcomed, and you were unclean. But then Jesus stepped into Simon's story, and suddenly the man who used to live outside the village is now hosting a dinner party of his own, and he's thinking, we've got to celebrate. So he invites Jesus, and he invites the disciples and a few other friends, including his friend Lazarus, which is a pretty good guest to have at your party, right? Because Lazarus has had a pretty big couple of weeks. Like, I mean, think about it. Think of the conversation that's going on in the room, right? There's Simon saying, hey, mate, like, it felt like I was dead to everyone. And then Lazarus is like, yeah, bro, but I actually was dead. 4 days in the tomb, and then Jesus comes and stands outside the grave and he calls my name, and somehow life comes rushing back into my lungs. Can you imagine the stories that night? Simon telling how Jesus had healed him, Lazarus telling him how Jesus had raised him, and then the disciples, they're all chiming in with their behind-the-scenes look of all the things that have happened on the road, all the miracles and the crowds and the moments of the rumors that have spread across the villages, all the insight around that. And here they are at the party with the actual guy who literally brought power, the power of life over death in their lives. And meanwhile, Martha is in the kitchen doing what Martha does best. She's serving and she's preparing. She's making sure that everybody has what they need. And the atmosphere is joyful and it's relaxed and it's grateful. And everyone is telling their Jesus story. The food is good. The laughter is loud. The vibes are good, people. The vibes are good. And then suddenly everything changes. Like, have you ever been in a room like that? Like, the mood is good, energy is high, and then all of a sudden, someone says something or does something, and suddenly the whole atmosphere shifts. Like, the conversation stops. People look at each other, and the rest of the night is never quite the same. Because in the middle of this dinner, this is what happens. Mary enters, and she brings with her an outrageous gift. And what she does shocks everybody in the room. Judas reacts to it, and he raises his objection, and Jesus has to step in. And suddenly this fun dinner with friends is as uncomfortable as Passover lunch with your in-laws. I'm glad three people are married in this room. From this moment, everything is different. From this point forward, there's no avoiding why Jesus has come to Jerusalem. Because Mary does something that forces everyone to think in that room, to confront something that they've been trying not to think about. It's like a penny drops for everyone who's there to see this. It's clear now why they've come to Jerusalem. It's clear now what Jesus is there to do. It's clear now that what these next few days is exactly about. And everybody in that room has to decide something. And the truth is, everybody in this room today has to decide the same thing. Are you willing to follow Jesus to the cross? And so this story takes place in John chapter 12. And we start it at verse 1. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus therefore came to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they gave a dinner for him there. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those reclining with him at the table. Mary therefore took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. And Jesus said, "Leave her alone, so that she may be kept it, so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you will always have with you, but you do not always have me." Now, before we jump into what Mary does in this moment, there's something important we need to understand about Mary. Because many of us read this story through our modern eyes, but if you step into the cultural world of the first century, there's something that would have stood out immediately. Mary shouldn't have been in that room. She should have been in the kitchen. She should have been helping Martha. She should have been doing the women's work, not interrupting the men. Because in the cultural bubble of the first century, there had been this serious distortion of God's heart towards women. This wasn't God's design, but it had become the cultural reality. Women were often pushed to the margins of religious life. They were excluded from learning. They were excluded from theological conversations. They were excluded from discipleship. One prominent Jewish leader is quoted as saying, "Better is the wickedness of a man than the goodness of a woman." Now, sons, that's not the coffee mug you need to buy your mum for Mother's Day, all right? You can have that bit for free. In another ancient Jewish commentary, there's a story of a rabbi who was approached by a woman who had a theological question. And he wouldn't even respond to her with a word. And his son rebuked his dad and said, "But Dad, she comes from a wealthy family who might be able to give us some money for our traveling teaching ministry." But he still refused to answer her question. He did decide to send her a message, though, and he said, "Let the words of the Torah be burned rather than be given to a woman." So all of this gives us a glimpse into the cultural context that the people are living in. And that's why the way Jesus speaks and treats women is unrecognizable. How Jesus lifts up women, empowers women, and gives voice to women is nothing short of extraordinary in the first century. Jesus consistently invites women into the life of discipleship. He speaks with them, he teaches them, he honors them, and he allows them to sit in the places that culture said that they didn't belong. Which brings us back to Mary, and in Luke chapter 10, where there's a story of Martha in the kitchen, and she's doing the expected work of a Jewish woman, but we find Mary at the feet of Jesus, where she's in the position of a student before a rabbi. And this detail matters because in the ancient world, sitting at a rabbi's feet is the position of a disciple. It was where students sat to learn from their teacher. It's where disciples listened and were formed. And Mary has taken the posture of a disciple. And Martha isn't impressed. She doesn't like this, and she is insistent to Jesus that this isn't where Mary belongs. And so she comes to Jesus, and she basically says, "Hey, Jesus, this isn't right. She should be back in the kitchen. Send her back there to help with me with the womanly duties." And Jesus is all like, "Hey, take a chill pill, Martha." No, he doesn't say that, because not even Jesus is brave enough to say that to a woman in the kitchen. Jesus says, "Leave her be. She's chosen something better, and I'm not taking that away from her." Jesus publicly affirms Mary as a disciple. And it's in this moment of this story that echoes every time the gospel is read that Mary's choice is remembered. Not because she had a dramatic testimony like Lazarus. Her story isn't, "I was dead, but now I'm alive." She doesn't have a radical healing story like Simon the leper. Mary's story is quieter than that. Because Mary has been given a place in the story of Jesus. And Jesus draws our attention to her as an example. An ideal disciple. So what is it about Mary that Jesus wants us to see? It is her devotion to him. We're told that Mary took a pint of pure nard. It's an expensive perfume. And she poured it over Jesus' feet, and then she wiped his feet with her hair. And in doing so, the whole house was filled with the fragrance of this perfume. And this perfume wasn't ordinary. It wasn't the ancient version of a quick spray of deodorant for your guests when they arrived. This was something far more valuable. Pure nard didn't grow in Jerusalem. It came from the Himalayas, from northern India, which is a fair trek from Jerusalem. It's about 4,000 kilometers away, and today it would be about a 10-hour flight. But in the first century, you're talking about traders traveling across mountains and deserts and trade routes. It's caravans moving slowly through the ancient world, and you can just imagine that journey. Somewhere high in the mountains of the Himalayas, this plant is harvested and the oil is extracted, and then somehow across thousands of kilometers through traders and markets and merchants, it eventually makes its way to Jerusalem. This perfume had traveled a long way, which means it's rare. And because it's rare, it's expensive. This wasn't just perfume. This was the kind of gift that was given to royalty. It's the kind of gift that you would present to a king. In fact, we're told it's worth, or its value was about a year's wages. It's worth everything you would earn in 12 months. And Mary pours it out. She pours the whole thing out onto the feet of Jesus. It's extravagant generosity. It's extravagant devotion. And now scholars have wrestled with this question for a long time. How did Mary have something like this? She's not presented in the Gospels as wealthy. She seems like a fairly ordinary woman from a fairly ordinary household. And so why does she have something so valuable? One common theory is that this perfume was part of her dowry and it was a treasure for her future. But instead of saving it, she pours it out. She takes this thing that represented her future and she places it at the feet of Jesus and she begins to wash them. Now, in a city like Jerusalem, where the streets are dusty and people wore sandals, washing someone's feet when they arrived at your house was normal hospitality. The washing of the feet wasn't performed by just anyone. It was reserved for your slave or your servant and the lowest ranking slave at that. They were the people that would take the filthy, sweaty, gross feet and wash them. It certainly wouldn't be done by someone who could afford perfume like this. What we see in Mary is remarkable. She willingly pours herself out. She humbles herself before Jesus, and she boldly defies the expectations of her culture in order to honor him. But there's another detail here that would have shocked everyone in the room. John tells us that Mary wipes Jesus' feet with her hair. Now, for most of us here, that probably just feels like a very unusual detail. But in the first century Jewish world, this was incredibly scandalous because respectable women did not let their hair down. Hair was kept covered. Hair was kept tied up. Letting your hair down was an intimate act. Something that happened only in the privacy of your home, something that was reserved for the presence of your husband. But here is Mary, who we don't think was married. She lived with her brother Lazarus and her sister Martha. And so you can imagine this moment, a room full of men, a dinner party, and suddenly Mary kneels down, pours out this perfume, and lets her hair down to wipe Jesus' feet. People would have been stunned. The room would have gone quiet. Some would have been embarrassed and others offended. And so there's a couple of theories of why her hair might have been down. The most common thought is that Mary was apologetic as she was repentant. Because just days earlier, she had confronted Jesus over her grief about Lazarus's death. She said, like, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. And maybe she felt regret. Maybe she felt sorrow and that her hair was uncovered to display this, to display her sorry. The other thought was that Mary was mourning, that she was grieving. In Jewish culture, women sometimes let their hair down in moments of grief, allowing their appearance to reflect the turmoil of their hearts. But what probably happened was in a moment of impulsiveness. She'd been sitting there in the room listening to the stories. listening to Simon talk about his healing, listening to Lazarus talking about coming out of the tomb, listening to the disciples talking about everything Jesus had been doing, and suddenly the reality of who Jesus is just overwhelmed her, and suddenly her gratitude has flooded her heart, her love for Jesus has filled her soul, and she just couldn't sit there anymore, and so she goes and she grabs the perfume, and there's no plan, there's no careful thought about this moment, it's just a heart overflowing with worship, and she's so caught up in this moment that she just forgets to bring the towel. And so it's the only thing that she has left to give. It's the only thing that she can think to do. It's to take out her hair and to use that and to finish the act of honor that she had begun. And in that moment, John tells us something fascinating, that the whole house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. Now, I don't know how many of us in the room have or are raising boys in our lives, but in our family, we have recently reached the preteen stage in our house, which means deodorant has become an important part of the daily routine. And let me tell you that when a preteen boy discovers deodorant, there only seems to be one rule. A little is good. A lot must be better. And even after he's left for school, the smell lingers. It's like he's marked his territory for the day. Like no exhaust fan possibly ever invented could deal with this. And you just walk through the house and you think, yep, he was here. And in a similar way, Mary's devotion releases a fragrance that fills the entire house. It overwhelms everything else. It rises above the food that's being prepared, above the dust of the travelers who've walked those roads, above the animals in the nearby barns. It's just unavoidable. Wherever you are, wherever you stand in that house, you can smell it. And I think that's the question this moment is quietly asking all of us. Does our devotion to Jesus leave a fragrance? Does the way we follow him, the way we worship, the way we serve, the way we give, does it leave a mark in the spaces that we inhabit? Not because we want to draw attention to ourselves, but because deep devotion to Jesus is simply unavoidable and you notice it. I don't know about you, but I can think of people in my life who have left that kind of fragrance. People who have shaped me without even trying. Not because they sat me down one day and wanted to mentor me. Not because they intentionally discipled me, but because I watched them. I saw the way that they prayed, the way that they served. I saw their generosity. I saw their passion in their worship and the way that they spoke about Jesus, how like he was actually real. And something in thought of me thought, hey, when I grow up, I want to love Jesus like that. But if we're also honest, there are peoples whose fragrance have a stench to it. And instead of inspiring us towards Jesus, their lives quietly push us away. And as this beautiful fragrance fills the house in Bethany, suddenly Judas breaks the silence. Judas is the disciple who in a few days' time will betray Jesus. And he objects to what's going on when he says, why wasn't this perfume sold? Why didn't we give the money then to the poor? It's worth a whole year's wages. Now, on the surface, this can seem or sound like a reasonable question to ask. And in fact, it sounds quite spiritual. It sounds compassionate. It sounds responsible. But John has pulled the curtain back for us. He tells us that Judas didn't say this because he cared about the poor. He said it because he was a thief. And as the keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to it. In this room are the people who had the closest access to Jesus anybody could have ever possibly had. They walked with him, they ate with him, they listened to him teach, they watched him heal the sick and raise the dead, and yet two completely different responses emerge. One person can't contain her devotion, and the other is quietly protecting his own interests. Mary pours everything out, Judas holds something back. Mary gives her whole heart, Judas gives Jesus only what serves him. And if we're honest, Judas's struggle can feel uncomfortably familiar to us. Because sometimes we like Jesus as long as he fits within the life that we want. You know, we like church, we like our community, we like the moments when Jesus seems to bless the things that we already value, but full surrender, that's hard. And that's what's going on for Judas here. He was happy to follow Jesus when things were trending in the direction that he wanted. He was up for the fight against Rome because that served his politics. He liked it when the crowds came and gathered to listen to Jesus because that increased his own influence. He liked it when people gave to the ministry because that served his own financial goals. But when Jesus continued towards the completion of his mission, and as he got closer and closer to the cross, and as it became obvious that this path involved sacrifice rather than power, something inside of Judas began to resist. And what had been quietly growing in his heart started to surface. Out came his selfishness, his pride, his deception. It all comes to the surface and it gets exposed, and that's where his objection came from. I don't know about you, but I can be very good at covering my lack of full devotion with some very holy sounding language. Like, you've probably never done this, but like, you know, you've been a jerk to someone because they were just asking for it, and so you called it justice. Or you stayed in a relationship or in a particular situation longer than you should have, knowing that that environment wasn't good for your soul, and so you called it loyalty or compassion instead of compromise. Or the times where you've held back resources and you've called it financial wisdom. Or when I've had a request to come and serve, and I've said no, because, and I've called it Sabbath rest. Jesus didn't have Judas's full heart. He was self-centered, he was proud, he was deceiving, and he was drifting. You see, people don't usually betray Jesus in a singular, dramatic moment. It's not an impulsive decision. It almost never starts there. It begins with small compromises. It begins with the quiet ones and the hidden ones. It comes from compromise. Maybe the first time that Judas slips a few coins out from the treasury, just a couple, no one noticed. And he told himself, hey, it's not a big deal. But compromise has a way of dulling the heart. And over time, the gap between the life Jesus calls us to and the life that we're actually living slowly widens. Until eventually something that once felt unthinkable suddenly feels possible. And so by the time that Judas reaches Jerusalem, Judas's heart has drifted so far that handing Jesus over for 30 pieces of silver doesn't feel like the enormous betrayal that it actually is. And then in this room, Jesus speaks and he says, leave her alone. The room had filled with tension and Jesus cuts through it. He says something that must have puzzled everybody in the room. This perfume was always meant for the day of my burial. In what Mary thought was a response to her overwhelming gratitude and joy towards her Jesus, towards her King, was just a spontaneous response out of deep devotion. Jesus says, hey, Mary, you are doing more than you realize. You think this is an act of gratitude, but what you've done is prepare me for what is to come, for what comes next. Because in just a few days, Jesus will walk back into Jerusalem. And he will be crowned, but not with a crown of gold, but with a crown of thorns. His throne will not be a royal chair, it will be the cross. And as the fragrance of that perfume fills the house in Bethany, Jesus knows that soon his body will be broken and prepared for burial. And somehow, in this moment of pure devotion, Mary has stepped into the story. She has acted out a truth that others still don't fully understand. It's almost like Jesus pauses and looks around the room and looks at the disciples and at the men who have walked with him for years, and without saying it directly, this message hangs in the air. She gets it. She gets it. This is what a disciple looks like. And here's the thing for us. If we walk out of here today thinking, hey, right, I need to try harder to be more devoted, like, that's not going to last very long. Because devotion that is built on effort alone eventually feels like obligation and duty and religion. And that's not what Jesus is inviting us into. And that's just not the invitation of the gospel. Mary's devotion didn't come from trying harder. It came from seeing Jesus clearly, from recognizing his goodness, from experiencing his grace. And when your heart is captured by the goodness of Jesus, devotion becomes your natural response. So how do we live this kind of life? How do we grow into this kind of devotion? Maybe it starts with some simple things. Maybe it starts with celebration, like celebrating the goodness of God in your life. That's what Simon was doing, a man who had been isolated and rejected and then healed by Jesus. That's what Lazarus was doing, a man who literally walked out of the tomb because Jesus called his name. Celebrate how Martha did, like serving with joy because her brother had been given back to her. Celebrate the way that Mary did when Jesus took her from the fringes and into a deep relational life with him. See, every single one of us, pardon me, every single one of us has a story of God's grace in our lives because Jesus is really good at bringing dead things back to life. He restores and he redeems and he heals what is broken. Jesus has begun a good thing, a good work in each of our lives, and he is not done. He has come to bring you freedom, and he has come to bring you life, and not just any sort of life, but life in abundance. So celebrate the goodness of God. Celebrate the mercy and the grace and the forgiveness of God in your life. Pour yourselves out as living sacrifices in the way in which you celebrate what Jesus has done. Maybe the second step is simply to ask him. Ask that if the Spirit of God is stirring something in your heart today, ask the question, God, what are you doing in me? Is there something you are asking me to lay down? Is there something that I've been holding back from you? Is there part of my life that you are inviting me to surrender to you? Mary poured something out that day. And maybe God is gently asking you the same question. Is there something in your life that you need to pour out before him? Because sometimes the Spirit of God stirs something in us and we quietly push it away. You know, we stay seated. We stay comfortable. We ignore the nudge. I just don't want to raise my hands. I just don't want to step forward. I just don't want to receive prayer. and we talk ourselves out of responding. But maybe today is the moment that we don't push it away. Maybe today is the moment to not push it away. Maybe today is the moment to respond. And to respond in worship, and to respond with obedience, and to respond with generosity, to respond with a step of faith, and to stop sitting comfortably and actually move towards what Jesus is inviting you into. You see, the jars that the nard or the perfume was stored in was called an alabaster jar. And these had long necks. And the only way to get into what was inside of it was to break it. And once it was broken, there was no going back. There was no leftovers. There was no salvaging. There was no do-overs. So maybe your response today is to break it open, to make a move where there is no going back, not halfway in, not almost devoted, but fully all in. To say once and for all, hey, Jesus, you are far too good. You are far too good. You have been so, so good to me. So here I am. Here is all of me, Jesus. Here is all of my life and all of my heart and all of my future. Jesus, here is all of me. We're sitting in the room, friends. We're seeing the goodness of Jesus. We know the stories of the time and time again where he has been good. And the question is, how are you going to respond to him? Are you holding back? Or are you going all in like Mary? Let's pray. Jesus, in these moments we come and we ask that you, by your Holy Spirit, would reveal to us, that you would speak to us the parts in our lives where we have been holding back, the parts in our lives that we have been playing it safe, and that you would show us where you are inviting, what you are inviting us to. That we wouldn't be the sorts of people who hold back our exuberance and our enthusiasm and our passion to worship you, Jesus. We have seen your goodness in our lives. Over and over and over again, we have seen it. But we don't want to just see it and do nothing with it. We want to respond like Mary did. We want to give you all that we have, because there is nothing better. We want to give you all that we have. We want to give you all of our worship. We want to give you all of our devotion. We don't want to live in the comfort. We don't want to do this on our own terms. We want to do it your way, Jesus. So if there's things in our lives that are blocking that and it's stopping at and holding us back from that, would you show us it? Would you draw us into repentance? And would you set us free?
Yes, Jesus.
And we would give you all that we have, because there is no one better, Jesus. There is no one better than you, Jesus. And you have done so, so much. And you are so, so good. And you are worthy of everything that we have. In Jesus' name.